From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the program, a new claim of a decades-long case of sexual abuse at the University of Michigan, this time within the School of Music.
Prosecutors here are really trying to paint a picture of a man who closely mentored these very talented, very young women, often teenagers, who had devoted their whole lives to making it in this very cutthroat world of conservatories and professional classical music.
We'll also speak to the head of the state's largest teachers union about mandatory masking in schools.
Where there's great outbreak in communities, there is a higher number of outbreaks in schools. And so that's why this mandatory mask wearing is so pertinent, because it has to happen everywhere.
And because tomorrow is All Hallows Eve, a touch of the paranormal for you, we're going to visit with the co-founder of Detroit Paranormal Expeditions. Those conversations and more just ahead on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a man whose job is going into Michigan's most haunted places.
We heard a woman humming, and three or four of us heard it. There's no one else in the room at the Whitney and the Carriage House in downtown Detroit.
That's coming up later on the program, but first, yesterday morning on a quiet street in Ann Arbor, Homeland Security officers arrested a renowned violin teacher and former University of Michigan professor on charges of bringing a minor across state lines for sex. The charges against Stephen Shipps come 2 years after a bombshell investigation by the student newspaper The Michigan Daily revealed decades of sexual misconduct allegations against Shipps. And because Shipps had such a long history in the intense, insular world of classical music training, this case shines a light on the experiences of students decades ago and today. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells has been reporting on this. Hi, Kate.
Hi, April.
Kate, just to start out with, who is Stephen Shipps exactly?
Yeah, so Stephen Shipps, as you mentioned, you know, he's got a long career here. He taught for decades at Michigan. He taught at programs and schools around the globe. And prosecutors here are really trying to paint a picture of a man who closely mentored these very talented, very young women, often teenagers, who had devoted their whole lives to making it in this very cutthroat world of conservatories and professional classical music. And it's very much a world where, you know, reputation and who you trained under. Training under a guy like Stephen Shipps, it meant a lot.
What exactly is he charged with?
So this indictment, it's very, very brief. It's just a few pages. And what the charges are is there are two counts of bringing a minor girl across state lines with, quote, the intention of engaging in sexual activity, unquote. This is so early. There's so much that we don't know. We don't know the specifics or the name of this alleged victim. We don't know which states they're talking about here. But some of the folks who are familiar with the case that I talked to say, you know, Shipps taught at several prestigious universities and summer programs, and the U.S. Attorney's Office may try to build a case that he may have brought one of these alleged victims to a camp or a different school in another state. But right now, really all we have there is speculation.
Will you take us back to 2018 when the original piece came out in the Michigan Daily about Shipps? It's a harrowing read. Will you recap what it says?
Yeah, it is a piece written by a reporter, a student reporter named Sammy Sussman. And what is so, I think, powerful about the way Sammy reports this is that he's not a student who's been writing for the Daily or doing a lot of reporting. He's a classical music student. He is a composer and a bassist who very much grew up in this world. And Sammy's investigation first revealed that in 2017, an email from alleged victim of Shipps was sent to the then dean of the School of Music, Theater, and Dance by an anonymous victim.
I allege that I experienced statutory rape at the hands of your professor, Stephen Shipps. I'd like you to address that. I'm paraphrasing here, of course. The University of Michigan took over a year to respond to that email. The University of Michigan Police Department finally responded to that email after they became aware of my reporting in November, about 2 weeks before it was published.
So not only does Sammy's reporting show that the school has been alerted to this issue about Shipps for over a year, but what he is able to do as a reporter is sort of painstakingly trace back this chain of women going back through all of Shipps' career, back to the 1970s, who describe this pattern of experiences with ships, that he would be in this position of power, that he would agree to sort of take them under his wing, that they'd work together very closely. And the one woman who does put her name fully on the record in this piece, her name is Maureen O'Boyle. And she was a 17-year-old high school student in the 70s in Omaha, Nebraska. She was a real prodigy, and she would go over to Ships' house for lessons. And she says that at one of these lessons, or one of these times at his house, he gave her alcohol and marijuana, and she says she became intoxicated and alleges that he sexually assaulted her. She says that after that, he would continue to engage her in sexual activity, that she never knew if their lesson was going to be an actual music lesson or if it would be something else. Now, today, she's a professional musician. She is a professor herself. And it wasn't until all these years later, when Sammy, the Daily Reporter, starts doing his reporting and reaching out, that she even considers speaking publicly about this.
What I realized is that they're looking for a way to stop something that is still happening now. And when I got that, I was horrified. I think there was a part of me that somehow thought, oh, that must have just been me, or I don't know, it was such a weird situation. And so to get some information that it's like, no, this is still essentially happening, and the only way to get this article to come out and have some impact is if there's somebody willing to give a name, I was like, that I can totally do. That I'm totally willing to do.
And Kate, Maureen is the only woman from this article in 2018 who uses her name on the record, but in the piece there are several others who make additional allegations against Ships. How long are they saying that this kind of behavior was going on?
For a long time. I mean, after Maureen, there's a second woman who goes by the pseudonym of Anne. She says she was also a student of Ships, this time in the 80s when he was teaching in North Carolina. She alleges a similar sexual relationship with Ships as his 16-year-old student at the time. Notably, though, and possibly consequently for a criminal case, she kept a diary describing what was happening. And Sammy's piece in the Daily, it quotes this part from Anne's diary that I think is worth actually pulling out here, because it really illustrates in the mind of this 16-year-old the kind of power that a teacher in this world has over her. She writes in this diary when she was 16, quote, "The things that would happen if we were found out would be he would probably be fired, but first I would be thrown out of school. Every connection I might have through him would be a negative one rather than a positive one, if at all. I guess what I'm saying is that I would sort of be blacklisted. In other words, nobody can know. I need him as a teacher at this point in my life." And then after North Carolina, Ships gets hired by the University of Michigan in 1989. It's unclear whether or if the university knew anything about these rumors that by then were surrounding Ships about him having these inappropriate relationships, quote unquote, relationships with his students.
So he comes to Michigan, and he's a professor here for 30 years. What do we know about what happens during that period?
So again, this is Sammy's reporting that really uncovers this, but he finds and talks to a series of women and girls ranging from as young as middle schoolers that were taught by Ships at a prep academy in Ann Arbor, through people who are currently still faculty members who allege that Ships either touched them inappropriately or made unwanted sexual remarks to them, but that this really never is publicly revealed until 2018, when Sammy's piece comes out in the Daily. Ships was put on leave by the university that same month. They say they did that immediately as soon as they learned of the allegations, and then Ships officially retired the next year, 2019, and now here we are in 2020 and he's facing criminal charges.
Well, Kate, now that he has been arrested and charged, do we know exactly what's next for him, or maybe the music school or the U of M as a result of this?
So Ships, specifically with his case, he will be arraigned next week. We reached out to his attorney for comment. The attorney declined to comment. You know, the university is dealing with several cases like this right now that we're all familiar with. You know, we had the former provost, Martin Filbert. We have the case against Dr. Anderson moving forward. And it's really a time of reckoning for a lot of students and members of that community, including Sammy, you know, Sussman. He's still technically part of the School of Music and Theater and Dance, where Ships worked. Sammy's currently taking a gap year. We talked yesterday, actually. I asked him how he found out about, you know, these indictments, which essentially have a straight line from his reporting to here we are with these crimes being charged against Ships. He says he learned about them when he was working his job in downtown Ann Arbor at the Bubble Tea Cafe, where he does the cash register. And he says his phone just started blowing up from these sources and these women. And he talked about watching what happened in his classical music world there at the university when these allegations came out in 2018, and how people responded to him, this person that they saw no longer as just, you know, this student and this member of their world, but also somebody who had kind of rocked the boat in a way, that they were a little more guarded around him, that they'd make these comments about, you know, oh, are you going to come after me now for this one awkward lesson that I had?
There was one professor that I worked with very closely right around the time this reporting came out. And he, you know, said, am I next? Are you working on an article about me? And I didn't know what to say at first, but then I tried to say, if I start talking to your former students, are there going to be, you know, 8 to 10 people who are going to allege sexual misconduct against you, and then 40 or 50 people who are going to allege that they were aware of that misconduct at the time? And he said, of course not. And so there's such a misperception there.
I can't tell you what this professor was thinking, because I haven't talked to him, but I can tell you what Maureen told me, which is that once this story came out, the reaction she got from a lot of people in her life who were men were sort of like, yeah, this is kind of par for the course. One person actually told her that it sounded like a great fantasy, and that the women of her generation didn't have stories to quite that extent, but they all sort of had their own experiences, where they would talk about, you know, the professor that they had in college, or, you know, their music teacher when they were in school, or, you know, that one teacher that everybody knew was sleeping with all his students. And a lot of these were college and above. But yes, is basically the answer to your question. That's part of the reason that in this world particularly, something like this could go on for so long. But it's also not as simple as just writing it off. What these women are alleging here is a crime, is a grown man grooming and sleeping with underage girls in a position of power. I think what I'm trying to say here is they are tied together. Alleged crimes like this can happen in a culture that is toxic like this, that allows certain kinds of behavior.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you, April.
Coming up, the case for masks in Michigan schools.
We're going to encourage our members to report when they don't feel safe.
We'll be back with that after a short break. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services yesterday announced an extension of rules around mask wearing and restaurant capacity, now that Governor Gretchen Whitmer's emergency powers have been curbed. Some Republicans in the state voiced frustration that the governor's administration is still making calls around COVID regulations without input from the legislature. But for now, the order that masks must be worn in businesses and schools continues. And that's frustrated some educators and districts. But the state's largest teachers union, the Michigan Education Association, is still putting the call out that mandatory mask wearing is the way to go. Joining us now to talk about masks in schools is Paula Herbart, president of the MEA. Paula, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me, April.
Among the schools in Michigan that have returned for face-to-face instruction, what we've been hearing from epidemiologists and health departments is that classroom instruction to this point has not been a super spreader situation. It has not been the largest point of contact at which COVID is spread, that there are certainly issues with school activities, that there are certainly issues with social events and parties where friends and family are coming together, or sometimes students are coming together. Why focus so hard on the classroom right now if schools have the option of doing the right thing themselves?
Well, the most important thing for us as educators who are dealing with students every day is, regardless of whether or not the super spreader is happening in the classroom, if there is contagion and spread in a community, then it bleeds into the classroom. And so if we're not practicing mask wearing out in the community, and then we are asking students to wear masks in school, does that really help mitigate the disease? And our concern is, as the Michigan Health Department of Health and Human Services stated, is where there's great outbreak in communities, there is a higher number of outbreaks in schools. And so that's why this mandatory mask wearing is so pertinent, because it has to happen everywhere.
What are you hearing from your membership, from teachers, about masks in school?
Well, they are appreciative of masks, but, you know, unfortunately, we've had two paraeducators from Mount Calm County pass away from COVID-19. Now, they're not doing the tracking and tracing and determining exactly where those individuals got their COVID. But when we lose members of our community, school communities, that is earth-shattering for us. And we are experiencing phone calls, emails, texts from members every day, the officers and I, about people who don't feel safe in school when they see the numbers rise. We know that we can mitigate the disease by wearing masks. And so educators are all about wearing masks and having students. But if you're not able to socially distance, if students aren't washing their hands, then this becomes problematic, because we know that all of these things need to happen. We need to wear a mask. We need to socially distance. We need to wash hands. And we need to stop touching our faces. And then, you know, with the shortage of teachers, people feel compelled to go to work. But what they really need to do is not go to work if they're sick. People need to stay home. Students need to stay home. And educators need to stay home if they don't feel well.
I just learned this week that Michigan's Christian schools, by and large, do not have a mask mandate, and many are not practicing it as a matter of choice in the classroom. I don't know how much overlap there is between people who currently teach in Michigan's public schools and people who teach in Christian schools or other kinds of maybe parochial education. But what have you learned by watching what's happening in private schools?
Well, it depends on the community in which they serve and whether or not there's greater outbreak there. We do see greater outbreak in schools, like I said, where there are communities of great outbreak. Where our members are being contracted by their school district to work in these parochial and private schools, we continue to talk about precautions for our members, because we cannot have our educators who are working in public schools with strict mandates going into places where there are not strict mandates. That is hazardous not only for the educator going in that building, but for the student population not in that school building, but in the school building which the educator will return to, the public schools. This is critical. Yes, mask wearing is a quote unquote choice, but it's an inconvenience and it's a health hazard right now. We stand firmly behind the necessity to wear masks, and we are calling on everyone to do that. You know, we remain steadfast in those issues, and we are not going to change our minds. We know that the University of Washington did a study recently that suggested that if 95% of the population wore face coverings and practice those social restrictions, that there would be approximately 130,000 fewer deaths from COVID-19 between now and February. That's critical. We cannot risk the health and safety of our students and the educators in our public schools and across the state. What I know is that when we come together as a country and as a state, we're more successful than ever and doing what's right by students and by educators. Educators since March have done everything that they've been asked to do. They changed the way that they taught. They made sure that students were fed and cared for. We've done all of those sorts of things. And now it's time for Michigan residents to do what's right by educators and do the simple things. Wear a mask, wash your hands, physically distance. That's imperative. And we need to make sure that real support of educators means supporting mandating masks and anything we can to mitigate this disease.
Paula Herbart is president of the Michigan Education Association. Paula, thanks for your time.
Thank you, April.
Surely you've heard of the Wolf Man. But do you know about the Dog Man? Stateside's Laura Weber Davis spoke with the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark about this eerie local legend.
He was 7 feet tall. He had shining eyes and a terrifying howl. He looked like a man, but was more like a dog. He was the Dog Man of Michigan. On this day before All Hallows Eve, let's explore the legend of the Dog Man from the late 1800s with Rachel Clark from the Michigan History Center. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you.
So, what is the legend of the Dog Man?
The legend of the Dog Man. So, this is a part man, part dog that people have been encountering throughout Michigan and parts of Wisconsin for about the last 130 years. The reports vary, but he's described being 7 foot tall when he stands on his two legs. His eyes are yellow or they're blue. He's very agile. His howl sounds like a human scream. He is everything you would expect to find in a dog man in the woods of Michigan.
So what were some of the specific reports that people had of sightings?
Back in some of the original encounters are a lot of logging camps that see him or her. I guess we assume it's a man.
And it could be a dog woman.
Yes. It was wearing pants. So that's 1887 in Wexford County. So the early reports are usually of men working in the woods who encounter this beast during their time there. And then over the years, it's a lot of times people who are, again, alone, either on an isolated road or in the woods. Their encounters are very similar, though. They do talk about this beast coming out of the woods. It is very agile. It jumps in front of their car or in front of them. It scratches at their houses or their tents. So the encounters, as described, are very, very similar in that way.
And do people report being afraid or just sort of surprised and confused?
Afraid. Very afraid. There have been reports, as any good story goes, that people have been scared to death by the sightings of the Dog Man. There have been quite a few of those, especially earlier on. And then the more recent encounters are just people who are afraid and also very confused at what they think they're seeing.
So how long did this saga last?
It has been actually going on for a long time. As I said, it starts in 1887 in Wexford County by two lumberjacks. And then the reports are Dog Man makes an appearance every 10 years on years that end with a 7. So starts in 1887.
That's so funny.
Recorded encounters. And then 97, 07, and so on, all the way up through. So that is how those encounters tend to go. I don't know where he's going for those other 10 years, but apparently a couple years ago, he made an appearance somewhere.
So we know just based on human biology that we didn't have a man who was living for 100, 150 years as a dog man. Were there any confirmed sightings or anything that we knew that sort of pinpointed who or what this might be?
There have been, especially in recent times, reports and actual descriptions of the encounters and quote-unquote proof of the encounter. There are photographs. I just heard a OnStar phone call from somebody. Apparently, it was totally fake, but reporting to OnStar that Dog Man ran in front of his car and he flipped his car. But those are the types of evidence that people are putting forth. And then there is one film that came out called the Gable film.
Yes. What is the Gable film?
Yes. The Gable film. It looks like it's filmed on like nine millimeter film. And it looks like the 70s because of the vehicles. And there are people who look like they're on vacation and they're snowmobiling. And there's a young boy who has the camera when he's in his car and he's panning across the scenery in the car and he captures this thing in the woods that they're driving by. So the Gable film for a little bit was supposed to be the evidence of Dog Man's existence in northern Michigan, and then it came out to be completely fake. The people who created it admitted that they faked it. It's a really good fake. They did it. They put a lot of effort into it.
It kind of reminded me in watching it of the Blair Witch Project movie.
Blair Witch.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. Yep. Well, yes, like you said, it was a good fake. And there was a movie, I think, that was created around it as well, this legend.
Yep. You always get stuff like that.
Talk about popular culture as it relates to Dog Man.
Dogman appears in popular culture in the 80s. Steve Cook, who was a Traverse City disc jockey, wrote a song about the legend of Dogman. And so he sort of outlined this story in the song he put together, and then he played it on air. And this was, again, in 1987, a year ending in 7. And he is also purportedly behind that Gable film. So he just sort of did it as a, you know, a thing to do. He put the song together, he put it out there. But then people were reporting that they actually were seeing things. And so that's the earliest sort of pop culture reference that we can find in terms of the Dogman. Then again, people, and even if you look online, people report what they think they see in the woods of Michigan as something they cannot identify. Therefore, maybe it was Dogman because it was a beast and it was very large.
Dogman is the thing that just houses all of the things we cannot explain.
Exactly.
So tell me how this crosses lines into Wisconsin.
There is a very similar beast, I guess, the Beast of Bray Road, which I think is a pretty cool name. And those encounters in Wisconsin date to the 30s, and they're very similar. It's a dog-like man or a Sasquatch-like person. And this one is known for jumping over motorists to scare them and makes these very quick appearances. But again, it's very big. He's very elusive. He's very agile, very similar to Michigan's Dogman.
So either he's well-traveled or we have a whole species that we're unaware of.
Yes.
So why do you think stories like this persist in the minds of Michiganders?
My opinion, part of it is that Michigan and Wisconsin, there are just these huge tracts of land that are woods and open. And, you know, there are all sorts of things that live in it. And when people are hunting or fishing or camping and they see something, they could see all sorts of things that they can't explain. And if you get enough people who claim to encounter something, then these myths and legends perpetuate. So I think that it's just people encounter things in the woods that they can't explain. And, you know, you get people of similar thinking and they just sort of kind of go with one another. But, you know, for a long time, there were stories of large cats in Michigan that were sort of dismissed. And now we've got cougar sightings.
Yes, that's
there's quite
true.
A few in the last few months. Well, so I'm not saying there's a dog man out there that's going to show up. However, who knows what's living in the forests of Michigan?
I do know somebody who swears she saw a Black Panther or something cat-like run in front of her in northern Michigan, but I'm going to tell her maybe it was Dogman.
Who knows? If you only really can tell, apparently, if it stands up on its two legs.
All right, so it was probably a Black Panther. Right, Rachel Clark from the Michigan History Center, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
A cool summer morning in early June is when the legend began. At a nameless logging camp in Wexford County, where the Manistee River ran. 11 lumberjacks near the Garland Swamp found an animal they thought was a dog. In a playful mood, they chased it around till it ran inside a hollow log. A logger named Johnson grabbed him a stick and poked around inside. Then the thing let out an unearthly scream and came out. And stood upright. None of those men ever said very much about whatever happened then. They just packed up their belongings and left that night and were never heard from again. It was 10 years later in 97 when a farmer near Buckley was found. Slumped over his plow, his heart had stopped. There were dog tracks all around. 7 years past the turn of the century, they say a crazy old widow had a dream of dogs that circled her house at night. They walked like men and screamed.
This is Stateside. I'm April Bear. Grab your broomsticks and your cauldrons, my witches. It's time to start planning your pandemic Halloween. Of course, and boy am I tired of saying this, things will look a little differently this year. The CDC is advising against things like indoor haunted houses, boozy costume parties, and, most heartbreakingly, door-to-door trick-or-treating. Instead, the agency suggests leaving a bowl of individually wrapped candies at the end of the driveway for the kiddos to pick up from a safe distance. But hey, why not get a little more creative? That is what carpenter Matt Thompson in Garden City did. He created a Halloween zipline for socially distant trick-or-treating by stringing a metal cable from his porch to the sidewalk about 30 feet away.
So then I made this wooden box with pulleys on the top of it that would ride that cable like a zip line. Now, in that box, there's a couple of holes where you can put a couple cans in there for the adults that are taking their trick-or-treaters out. But on the front of it, there's this ghost that has two hands sticking out, and we attach candy using rubber bands.
In a video that Thompson posted on Facebook a couple of days ago, the ghost flies down the zip line to a tiny Ghostbuster and her dad waiting on the sidewalk.
Cheers. Once the trick-or-treaters have taken their candy and the parents have taken their beer, I then retrieve that using a fishing reel with a power drill attached to it.
Thompson says that he wants the things he builds to bring some fun and laughter into the world.
You know, you just you got to reinvent ways of doing things in life. You know, there's roadblocks in life. You just got to find a workaround.
Hey, that's pretty good advice for all of us in 2020.
After the break, we talk to a man who seeks out the paranormal in Michigan.
We'll get full sentences, we'll get full words, we'll get answers to our questions. And again, the theory, this is not a science, it's more of a pseudoscience, is that energies can manipulate radio frequencies or white noise to communicate.
That's coming up after the break. Don't miss it.
This is Stateside. I'm April Bear. That creak in the middle of the night, that sudden strange cold spot in a room, or a sensation that causes the hairs on your neck and arms to stand at attention? What is it about the spooky unknown? So hard to describe, yet so universally relatable that draws us in. Our next guest is, shall we say, passionately paranormal, and we're hoping he can shed some light on this. Todd Bonner is the co-founder of Detroit Paranormal Expeditions. Todd, welcome to Stateside.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, how does one get into this field in the first place? Did you have a personal experience?
Me personally, it's kind of a weird story. I have had a few near-death experiences, three to be exact. And I had my first, I guess, paranormal experience at Eloise Psychiatric Hospital in Westland, Michigan, when I was around 16. So it was late 80s, like 89, 88. I heard a disembodied voice, basically, told me to get out. It was a male voice. But I knew at that point it wasn't someone there with me. It was something else. But back then, you couldn't really talk about it openly. Like, now we're talking about paranormal stuff on your show. Back in those days, it wasn't mainstream. It wasn't on TV. And I grew up, my father was a police officer. And I grew up in a police officer's household. I went to Catholic schools. So it was kind of taboo to talk about that stuff or come out with it, I guess.
Right.
So when I got older, it was around 10 years ago, I decided to join a team.
Todd, I'm sorry to interrupt, but could you sort of take us back to like the circumstances under which you were on site there when you heard this?
Sure. Now there's only a few buildings left at Eloise. Back in those days, there was probably 40 buildings left, very large buildings. And it was kind of fun to urban explore in high school, so we'd freak ourselves out. So the girl I was dating at the time and I went with a group of people. We went down in the basement of this large, it had to be over 200,000 square feet, building. So we kind of broke off from the other group. And there was old files and medical records. It was kind of cool just to go through there, but it was scary at the same time. So we're, you know, a little on edge. And we both heard a voice saying, get out, you need to leave. So to me, I didn't want to scare the girl I was with too much. I said, oh, it's probably those guys playing a joke on us, other people we were with. And so we kind of searched around. But I knew inside of me that that was not someone that was alive. It sounded like a person, but it just sounded different. And when I got into the paranormal more, like I do now, I can kind of differentiate between the two sounds and make them out better. But we found the other people on the fourth floor at the back of the building. So there was no one in the area we were at. There was no one even close to us. So I kind of just wrote it off to her, but it always stuck with me. And I always had an interest in it. I kind of went on with my life and always looked at paranormal stuff and watched the movies and stuff that would come out until I got a little bit older. And that's when I finally decided to come out of the paranormal closet and join a team. And I really didn't care what people thought about me at that point. I just wanted, I had a passion for it. I love it. And I think like the near-death experiences I had and that first paranormal experience kind of pushed me to where I am today.
Yeah. Well, how old were you and what was going on in your life when you started going out on expeditions and treating this like research?
Well, it was about 10 years ago. So I had an opportunity to join a team. It was a friend of a friend. Knew I had an interest in it. They had an opening on their team and I joined the team and I met Jeff Atkins, who was the co-founder of Detroit Paranormal Expeditions. So we were on that team together and we kind of learned and grew, but we want to do more. We want to travel more. We want to investigate more. We want to do more research. The historical side, we really love a lot of historical preservation. So we just had an idea of what we became with Detroit Paranormal Expeditions to actually, we work with a lot of charities too. We've donated to Ronald McDonald House of Detroit, Gleaners. So we use the paranormal, which we love to do, but we also use it to help people that necessarily aren't into the paranormal. They don't know that money is coming to them, but it's kind of been a great journey for us. It's been fun and we're able to help a lot of different people out and go to a lot of amazing places too.
What equipment do you bring along when you're going out on an investigation?
We have a lot of stuff that you see on TV, digital recorders, K2 detectors that pick up electromagnetic fields. The theory is energies or spirits can give off energy and it'll make these detectors go off. We use full spectrum cameras. And what we're kind of known for are ghost boxes or spirit boxes. And that's kind of the main thing that we use a lot of the times. It's kind of hard to explain, but we have some boxes that are made from, they look like old antique radios. And actually we have an antique radio that's been converted to a ghost box. What it does is we think that a lot of these places have energy retained in their walls even. So we've gathered wood from Eloise and a couple other places. And a friend of ours actually builds these boxes out of wood from haunted locations. I don't know exactly what internals they put in. They put an amp in there and different speakers and echo systems. And we use a hacked radio. So these radios don't stop scanning. They just continuously scan radio stations. It usually scans 100 radio stations per minute. And you only get a fraction of the radio station. And a lot of times when we try to communicate or ask questions, we'll get full sentences, we'll get full words, we get answers to our questions. And again, the theory, this is not a science, it's more of a pseudoscience, is that energies can manipulate radio frequencies or white noise to communicate.
So I have to ask you, I've been at home alone and heard voices that really, really gave me a scare. And realized that my stereo receiver was powered up, but not tuned in.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, you know, a radio frequency was sort of appearing unannounced because of the radio equipment. How do you differentiate between what comes across normal radio signals and the kind of voices that you're looking for from another world?
Well, we're used to this, so we tune our hearing into it. But you can kind of tell if it's a radio station or if you ask a direct question, you get an answer back through the ghost box. We were at the Sixth Precinct last night and we were getting like words like police officer and Detroit, Sixth Precinct, like it was telling us where we're at. And we said, can you see how many people are in this room? It would give us a number. And sometimes they actually say swear words. The other night it said F you to me. So those aren't on, we scan 80 AM radio stations. And you know, those kind of words would not be on AM radio or any radio station, actually.
Right. What's the most intense audio that you've ever recorded?
One happened that I think is probably, it freaked me out the most, I guess, was on Beaver Island at the North Lighthouse. The innkeeper's house is pretty big there. It's attached to like a breezeway, then it attaches itself to the actual lighthouse. Well, the house itself was locked. We had went there to investigate the Historical Society, and people on the island said, you got to go check the lighthouse out. It's haunted. There's all these rumors. So we drove over there. It's like a 20-minute drive out in the outskirts of the island. There's nothing around there. We had our psychic with us, Brandy Miller, and she had said she felt a woman on the front porch. I know this all sounds crazy, but it blows me away still, telling us to go. You need to leave. So Jeff and I, as the paranormal investigators we are, said, we're going to try and go in this place. So when we went there, you can actually get into the breezeway. There's a guest book you can sign and you can actually go up in the lighthouse itself. So we kept hearing stuff on the house side where the door was locked, things moving. So I took out a digital recorder. We had our Sony and we started asking questions and you could hear Jeff saying, what if I, you know, can you shake this door handle for me? And I joke, what if you did that? And the door just opened. Well, right when I said that, there's a voice that sounds like something from The Exorcist. The first part says shipwreck. And then to me, it says, I told you to go. And we did not hear that in the moment. We were staying at on the Central Michigan campus. They have a biological campus there. And they let us stay with them for the weekend that we were there. So we went back and we were staying in the cabins. And I started just listening to these. So I put my headphones on, started listening to the audio back.
You can't shake this door handle for me like this. Can you do that?
What if you did that and the door just opened and it wasn't locked anymore?
You should be like, I told you to go.
And I threw my headphones off because it freaked me out so bad. I've never heard anything like that. And it's louder than our voices, and yet we did not hear it in the moment.
Wow. When you go out with the team, would you be more likely to try to visit places that are well known to have stories, places that people talk about as the haunted places in Michigan? Or do you prefer to go places that are less well explored?
It seems for us, and we've been very lucky and fortunate to get in places that have never been had paranormal investigations before. And to me and the rest of our group, it seems like those places are more active. And the only reason I can think why is because we're actually trying to communicate with whatever's there. And that could be the first time that either us or them have had an opportunity to talk finally. So we find that places that, and I'm not saying that places that aren't, you know, investigated all the time, the big well-known ones, aren't active also, but it just seems to us in our experience that the first time ever investigated places seem really, really active. We were the first group to ever investigate Eloise Psychiatric Hospital back in 2018. And that was a really active investigation. And we've done the Sixth Precinct is another one we do downtown Detroit. And we're the first ones there. And it was really, really active. It's still active, but it seemed like the first night we were there, it just had so much activity. But that's just with our experience. You know, other groups and teams have different experiences that way. And it doesn't have to be well-known either. We do a lot of historical societies and small houses. There's a farmhouse in Taylor called the Norris Farm. It's not well-known at all. And we've investigated it. First time ever there. First time ever investigated. And we got crazy activity. So we just try to find places like that and research the history and find out what's been going on there and talk to people. And that's how we go about our business usually.
You know, I am not saying that this is not interesting work, but what do you enjoy about it? I mean, most of us, the experience of getting a scare like that is something that we gravitate away from rather than toward.
I know, it seems weird. It seems really weird, and I guess I'm considered a weirdo. I'm actually normal. I have a normal life. I have kids and everything else outside of this. It's so hard for me to explain. It seems like it's a thrill seeker almost, like people that, you know, do rock climbing or roller coasters or skydiving, I guess they get that same kind of feeling. It's a rush sometimes when things happen. And it's fun. It's so much fun. And the people I've gotten to meet in the history. I wasn't into history in grade school and high school and college. But as I got older, I really love history and uncovering some history in Michigan, especially. There's things that happen in Michigan I didn't even know about until we researched these places we go to. And historical preservation, I hate to see these buildings knocked down and you know, put new neighborhoods in. Hopefully a lot of these can get preserved, and we try to work with groups to preserve historical locations. But it's a rush, you know, that's the main thing, and it's fun, and I can't get enough of it. It keeps making me go back for more to see what's going to happen next, you know what I mean?
Have you and Jeff, your colleague, Jeff Adkins, have you come up with any theories about the voices or the feelings that you have tracked over the years?
We have different opinions on that. And I can't really say, and you get some people that are religious, say it's demons, and we've never met anything demonic or anything close to that. I think that it's people that passed on, and for some reason, their energy lingered. Not everybody stays for some reason, and I can't figure that out. But some of their energy lingers, and we're able to communicate. There's theories that people say it's a parallel universe, it's aliens. I mean, you get all kinds of crazy reasons of what those voices are. And I can't for sure say they're ghosts, because that's, you know, like a pseudoscience. No scientific evidence. And we're using equipment that other paranormal people build. There's no store like Walmart or Best Buy that you can go into and buy paranormal equipment. So we're relying on other people to build these pieces of equipment that we use. Me personally, I think it's we're communicating with people. And I have no idea why they still linger. Why? I mean, it could be everyone's still around. Just some people have enough energy to speak to us and communicate. We find even last night, Brandy, she's a tremendous psychic, and I don't know how all psychics work. It's fascinating to me, but she connected with someone's mother last night. Total strangers. She never met these people before. We were at the sixth precinct. And the woman actually started to cry because Brandy was talking about so much personal information that she would never know. So I think a lot of times those energies or spirits that try to communicate, they're trying to let their loved ones know that they're okay. Some people grieve a lot longer than others, you know, to hold on to that. You know, after people die, they're so close to them, they just want to know they're okay. And I think sometimes those voices that we get are just letting their loved ones know they're okay or trying to get a message across.
Todd Bonner is the co-founder of Detroit Paranormal Expeditions. Todd, it's great talking to you. Thanks for taking a couple minutes to speak with us.
Thank you, too, and happy Halloween. Have a good weekend.
In today's edition of Cheers, Michigan Radio's Lester Graham and mixologist Tammy Coxon are making a Michigan sling with a cherry spirit from up north.
Cheers.
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 Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. I'm Lester Graham, and we're here to take a look at a cocktail with Michigan ingredients. And you've got Knickerbocker gin in this. I used that in my martini recipe in our book, Cheers to Michigan. But you've got something else here that I have no idea what this is. Mammoth Distillings Cherry Bounce. What is that?
Bounce was a cordial of sorts that people would make themselves. So the way I know to make it is you take some cherries when they're in season, nice Michigan tart cherries, and you soak them in rye whiskey and some sugar, and then you put them away and you let them sit until Christmas, and then you open it up at Christmas and share out little cordial glasses of this with all your friends and family, maybe bigger glasses.
That doesn't sound terrible.
It's really tasty stuff. I have made my own, and so this is Mammoth's take on that cherry bounce tradition.
Was there a demand for cherry bounce? Why did they start making it?
Because it's delicious.
Okay. Well, you've got it, and you're calling this a Michigan sling. Is that anything like a Singapore sling?
Exactly. I tasted the cherry bounce, and the thing it reminded me of was cherry hearing. Do you know that ingredient?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Right. I've never really liked cherry hearing. It's an important ingredient in some classic cocktails, but on its own, it's heavy, it's thick, it just doesn't taste very good. Where the cherry bounce had the things that I like about cherry hearing and none of the things that I didn't like. So I thought, I'm going to take this and swap it for cherry hearing in a classic Singapore sling recipe and see how it turns out.
Okay, classic, although I see you've got a lemon out, not lime.
You have studied up, Lester, to know what this recipe is supposed to contain.
Well, you were practicing on perfecting the Singapore sling some time ago, and I was paying attention.
There are a lot of different recipes for Singapore slings that go around. This is a version from David Wondrich. He's a cocktail historian and author. And he went back to newspaper clippings from Singapore in 1913 and earlier and was like looking around trying to find the origins of the Singapore sling and what the original recipe would have included, because it's totally changed. And so this is his take from those articles about the original. So it's equal parts gin. I used Knickerbocker, Benedictine, French herbal liqueur, cherry brandy, using the cherry bounce here, and then normally lime juice. And I just thought lemon would go better with the other ingredients.
Okay, how do you make that all together?
I combine all those ingredients I just talked about, along with a dash of Angostura bitters, into a cocktail shaker. I'm going to add some ice, give it a good shake, and strain it into a tall glass. I'm gonna add a little bit of club soda, probably about an ounce, fill the glass up with ice. And then just a dash of Angostura bitters on top to really give some nice spice aroma when you bring it to your nose.
Oh, sounds nice. Can we taste it now?
Yes.
Oh, that's really nice. Now, I've had a few Singapore slings. Some of them have been better than others. I really like this Michigan sling. I'm not sure what's different about it. I guess probably the cherry bounce and the lemon, but it's really nice and refreshing.
I forgot to mention that the cherry bounce also has some spices included in it. Mm. So between those spices and the ones that are in the Angostura bitters, you really get a nice kind of fall-flavored sling here, rather than it being a really bright summery drink, which is what you would want in Singapore.
Well, you certainly get that. In fact, you know, because of Angostura, I have no idea what they have in that, but it always has that little bit of a spice that I like a lot. And that, along with what you've got in here, the Benedictine and the cherry balance. And Knickerbocker gin, of course, is a little different than the typical London dry gin. So
right.
It all goes together very nicely.
Right. It has those spice notes, too. So we're really kind of bringing this home for fall.
All right. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.